This is called reading the Bible for all it's worth, and everybody says, well, I already read the Bible. Okay, I know that. We all agree that this is God's Word. That's why we're here. But maybe there's a question that you haven't thought of that I wanted to explore a little bit today, and that is, think about all the ways that God could have communicated to us, and He chose a certain kind of method, and we're going to look at that method today. In fact, there's more than one method. So let's just start in. You may say, what in the world is he talking about? Let's just go to Genesis, right? That's a good place to start. So I'm going to have you hopping around a little bit in the Bible today. Everybody knows this. That's why I wanted to start with something that you're already comfortable with. But Genesis 1, what's going on there? The beginning, right? Everything gets created. How about Genesis 2? Creation again, and this time a little more focus on people being created, Adam and Eve in the garden, and of course what God told them to do and not do. We see in chapter 3, unfortunately, mine is subtitled The Fall of Man. That's a pretty grim chapter, isn't it? When they were presented with so much, and then they blew it. How about chapter 4? Well, things get worse, don't they? Now we get the first murder. I'm going to skip over 5 for now. That's just more of a genealogy. But 6 brings up a whole new section. What's going on there? The famous story we all loved when we were kids, right? The Noah and the Ark story, the destruction of the world. We don't think of the destruction. We just think of the Ark when we're kids and all these animals going up. It's a great flannel graph sort of story. So you're saying, okay, I know all of this stuff. Well, what did you notice, though, is the main thing that God is using in these early chapters of the Bible, and He's going to use it all the rest of the Bible. How is He getting across His information here?
Stories.
They're stories, right? Aren't they stories? And it doesn't end where I stopped it. Then we get Abraham. And don't we get a lot of stories about Abraham? Sure. And then his offspring, Isaac. And we get stories about Isaac. Not so much. Isaac's kind of a lost person. And then his son, Jacob. And we get all sorts of stories of Jacob. Jacob fills up a lot. And then we get the 12 tribes. And then we get Joseph. Joseph takes up the last part of Genesis. And then we get the story of the Exodus, right? It's story, it's story, it's story, it's story. And it goes on into the New Testament. What do we have the Gospels for? To tell us the story of Jesus, right? So there's a lot of storytelling that goes on in the Bible. So that's one thing. That's one kind of way that God has gotten through to us. But if you're still in Genesis, did you notice something in chapter 2 and chapter 3? There's some parts of this that don't look like the rest of it. It's laid out differently as far as the way the typing looks. So how about chapter 2, verse 23? Do you see something? Does your Bible set it up a little differently right there? Does that look a little different? Yeah, it looks like a quote, doesn't it? But even the quote is not quoted like you're telling a story. It looks like something a little different. But before you answer or think about it, go over to chapter 3. How about chapter 3, verse 14 through 19? Is that set up different in your Bible? Does that look a little different than the rest of it? Okay, so something's going on there. All right, for most of you, I have a good audience here. If it was younger people, they'd probably cringe when I say this, but what do we have here? Poetry. These are poems. Now, I'm saying young people don't like poetry very much. I bet your generation does. Mine does. I like poetry. Did you notice, by the way, what the first poem is in chapter 2? Here's our first poem of the Bible that we're going to meet. Who's speaking?
Adam.
Adam is speaking. What's he speaking about? His wife, Eve. The very first poem in the Bible is a man looks at a woman and says, I like that. And for thousands of years since then, it's always been, you know, Valentine's Day and all these love poems that get written, all these songs that get written. Here's the first song. Here's the first poem. It's about a woman. Not bad, huh? How about chapter 3? Not so happy there. Who's speaking in this one when you get to the poetry part?
Sure.
God is speaking here. Is this good news? Oh, this is bad news, right? This is the God saying, you've blown it, and here's what's going to happen. Here's going to, you know, looking at the man, looking at the woman, looking at the snake, all this sort of stuff. And so poetry doesn't always have to be love stuff, does it? Many poems are about love. But in the Bible, just so you think about this, whenever there's something where they want something more emotional, something very elevated, something really powerful, often God has these people switching to poetry. Do you notice most of the prophets? If you look at the prophets, you can take a second, sometimes flip through it, they're set up as poems. Right? Why are they set up as poems? Because the prophet was speaking what God told him to tell to the children of Israel. Usually, you have blown it and judgment is coming if you don't get your act together. Or, this is what's going to happen in the future, right? So there's a lot of poetry in the Bible. Those are the two main ways that God is using, has used to communicate his truth to us. So let's go through, I'm at letter B here. I think a lot of people have, so we're going to look at the two types of ways God has spoken. I think a lot of people have misconceptions about stories. Well, I shouldn't say about stories, but they have a misconception about the Bible. They don't think it has stories, right? If you talk to people that are not familiar with the Bible, they think it's a bunch of lectures, a bunch of sermons, a bunch of lists of what you can do and what you can't do. And that's not true. The Bible is full of stories. So why would God, out of all the ways that he could communicate to us, is there anything about stories that is powerful?
They usually teach a lesson.
Yeah, they usually teach a lesson. Is it more effective to tell a story that teaches a lesson or just tell people the lesson?
The story
is far more powerful, isn't it? When you're a kid, you heard maybe the Aesop stories or whatever it is. And what are they trying to do? Yeah, there's a lesson probably in there someplace. At least most good moral literature has some moral to it. But what are you doing? A story grabs you and it pulls you into the story and it gets you all involved with it. And then it leads to the meaning. But instead of just slapping you with a, you know, what you ought to do, what you shouldn't do, stories involve us, don't they? Think about Jesus. Somebody says to him, well, who's my neighbor? That's part of a longer conversation. I'm just cutting to the middle part there. Somebody says, so who's my neighbor? And what does Jesus do? He doesn't say, well, your neighbor is really far more widespread than you think it is. It's really not your cultural person you like. It's not the person who lives next door. It's anybody who has a need, right? That's your neighbor. But did he say that? He didn't say that. He told this famous story. What is it? The Good Samaritan story, right? So he tells the story. He doesn't even say, well, let me tell you a story. He just says, who's my neighbor? Well, there's this guy who went down to Jericho. And he starts in and he tells a story. My favorite story, I think, out of all the ones in the Bible is the prodigal son. Because it reveals how much God cares about me when I've turned my back on him. Isn't that a great story?
Yes.
The kid takes that inheritance, basically saying, I don't care if you die, Dad, give me the money now. Goes out and blows all that money. Comes back thinking, oh, all I can do is be a servant. And what does that dad do?
Takes him in.
And he runs. He apparently he's been looking for him, and he runs to him. And before the kid can get that little message out of his mouth about, hey, take me back, I'll do anything, he grabs him, he says, you're back, you're mine, I love you. And he says, kill the fatted calf, we're going to party like nothing.
If you've ever had a child that was wayward or has run away, it really means a lot.
Yeah. I haven't, but I just love that story because I just think in my own life, you know, how many times I've walked away and God's always there and he's still looking for me and he's so happy to have me back. He doesn't say, well, that's it. You've blown it too many times, you know. You're going to go through a lot of misery. He loves us. But we get that out of the story, don't we? It's the power of that story. So I just love stories in the Bible. Well, what about poetry, right? People don't love poetry as much. Okay, there are a lot of reasons, I'm afraid, for that. But can you turn to Psalm 1? Let's just take a look at a little bit longer poem rather than those little pieces that we did in Genesis. What did you notice? Let me read Psalm 1. It's very short. It says, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked or stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked, they're like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. You can't read a poem the same way you read the newspaper or a magazine or anything else, right? I mean, do you notice these lines are shorter than, my Bible is set up in columns here, and these lines are shorter than the column, right? So I keep having to stop, do you? At the end of a line, then you come back and you read a short line, you have to stop, you come again. That takes you longer to get through a sentence, doesn't it? So poetry slows you down. And I think there's a reason for that. Why do you think that is? Why would somebody use poetry? Why do they want you to slow down?
I want you to think about what you're reading.
There it is. That's why it's not very popular today. We're not really full of thinkers anymore, right? People don't want to think. And poetry says, no, this is important. Slow down. Think about this. Let's not move too fast. Time out, right? Enjoy it. Think about it. Meditate. Right? The Bible's full of references to meditation. Here's some meditating that could happen. So that's one thing you notice. Poetry is just set up differently. The lines are set up not just to be cute, but they're supposed to slow us down, kind of like speed bumps, you know, as we're going along here. Do you know something else about this? We're going to come back to it later. But the other thing that's characteristic, so one characteristic of poetry is set up in lines. But do you know something else? In verse 3, it says, talking about the righteous person, he's like a tree. And then in verse 4, it's talking about a wicked person, well, people, and it says they're like chaff. So you get these likes, right? What are they doing there?
Pictures.
They're what?
I call them pictures.
Exactly, those are pictures. They're called figures of speech. Mm-hmm. So we're going to come back to that in just a minute, but a figure of speech is... it's kind of like a high wire act, right? You'd pay good money to watch somebody kind of do something dangerous and daring. Well, in a sense, a figure of speech is a little bit dangerous, a little bit daring. Somebody says, I think this thing is a lot like this thing, and they'll take two items that you don't think have anything in common, put them together, and have you think about that and go, I don't get it. But then you get it after you read a little bit more, and you go, oh, okay, I guess there is something in common between those two things. So right now, I'm just going to leave that alone, but I just wanted you to think about it. Poetry often has something that makes you see. Right, it gives you a picture. In this case, we have the person is like a tree and the wicked are like chaff. So often they have pictures, and it's the lines that are set up in a certain way. Okay, so that's kind of our starting point today. I won't take too long. Does that make sense? There are stories in the Bible and there's poetry. That's the biggest chunk of the Bible. It's one of those two kinds of literature. So that's how God's communicating to us, often through stories, often through poetry. Are there some other things in the Bible? Yes, and we'll talk about those real briefly, but there's so much that I save that for a different talk, and I'll do that some other time if you care. But let's now then talk about, I'm on D. Okay, now that you know these things, right, there are often stories in the Bible, there's often some poetry in the Bible. How can we really enjoy and get the most out of reading these things, because we're going to be encountering them? So I'm going to suggest three things, and we're only going to have time for two today. One is, and you can see it here, using our imagination. And you say, well, I already use my imagination. Okay, you probably do, but we're going to do a couple of exercises here in a couple of minutes using some Bible stories that I hope has you thinking more about how to be imaginative as you're going through the Bible. The second thing I have down here is understanding two things about poetry. One is something called parallelism, and we'll talk about that in a second. And the other is talking about figures of speech, which we already introduced. But I'm going to explain a little bit more about that in just a second. Do you notice I also have a third item down there? And this is the one that we'll have to save for another time, and that is the Bible doesn't just have poetry and stories. It has other kinds of literature as well. And so if you're going to read the Bible and you encounter these other kinds of writing, wouldn't it be a good idea to know what some of the conventions are, what some of the expectations are, what some of the rules are for those kinds of pieces of writing? Just like today, we got a Charger game. If you bring a friend in who does not know football and sits him down, he's going to go, that is just total chaos. What in the world is going on out there? Flags are flying, and somebody's got a red flag, and they throw it on the field. What's that all about? And what's this stuff about guys looking under the hood, refs with weird striped shirts sometimes go under this blanket? What are they doing? You know, are they watching a rerun of I Dream of Jeannie? I mean, what is all this about? They don't understand the punts. They don't understand, is that a forward pass or not? Well, let's look at it slow motion. Let's see it from this angle, and you're going, what is all of this? So it really pays, doesn't it? If you're going to watch football and get interested in that, you better know some of the rules. So even literature has certain rules. It has certain expectations that you better be aware of. So that's going to have to be a different time. So we'll talk about that later. So let's go to E, right? Letter E. Imagination. So that's something that we're all supposed to have. Yes, we do, but we often don't use it as much as we could. So I want to take you to two small parts of the Bible today and have us apply and think about this imagination. So can you turn back to Genesis 22? It's a pretty famous section here. Mine's titled Abraham Tested.
Yes.
All right? Okay, so this is pretty well known. I just want to read the first two or three verses, and then I want us to stop and explore a little bit about what's going on here using our imagination. So Genesis 22, the first two or three verses, sometime later God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, Here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. So I'm just going to stop at that point. And you say, well, okay, I read that, I got it, I'll move on, and I'll get the point of the story. Yeah, you can do that, but I think you'll get a lot more out of it if you slow down again and think about that part that we just read. So here's my first question to you. Abraham is listening to the voice of God. What does that sound like?
He's praying.
I mean, is this...
Very scary.
Is it scary? Does it sound male, female? Is it an audible voice? If somebody was right there with Abraham, would he have heard it too? Or is this a voice inside his head? You ever wondered about that? These people always are talking to God. And you wonder, well, are they actually physically? Are they hearing sound waves? You know, they're hitting their ears. I don't have any answer, by the way. I'm just using my imagination. I'm slowing down. I'm thinking about, well, what would that be like if you heard the voice of God? People today will say things like that. I heard God talking to me. I don't think they mean sound waves, right? They're probably, it's something in their spirit. But I don't know. And there's, the Bible is very understated. You know what I mean by that? It doesn't give us as much information as we would like sometimes. We don't know often how people look. We don't know what else is going on. So we don't know enough here to know what the answer is. But we start thinking about that sort of stuff.
All I was thinking about was different Christian authors, and I'm talking about fiction. You know, they refer to being hearing what God said. And yeah. I always think, what an experience that would be. Mm-hmm. How can I do that too?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But if you have a conscience, I think you do hear up from God.
Yeah. But probably internally.
Yes. Oh, right. Yes, internally.
Yeah. Here's the second question for you. Again, just thinking about these things, I don't have answers. I'm just saying it made me think about it. God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. And we just read over that, we go, okay, I got it. But do you think about that? He said four things to Abraham. He says, take your son, he's your only son, his name's Isaac, and you love him. Right? There are four things stated there. Why would God go to that much trouble instead of just saying, take Isaac? Because we all know who Isaac is. You don't think Abraham knew who Isaac was? Why would he say four things to Abraham about his son?
Make sure he's the right one.
Well, he's the only one around, right? I mean, Ishmael is gone now. He's been banished, he and Hagar.
I think he's up in the stakes. He's letting him know that this is the one he really loves, and he's making sure he knows that, and then to ask him to sacrifice him.
See, that's what I think of. I don't know if that's right, but I just think he's tightening the screws a little bit on Abraham, isn't he?
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, hey, you know, Isaac, why don't you take him up? He says, what does he say here? He's your son. He's your only son. And you say, well, he had Ishmael. Yeah, but Ishmael's out of the scene now. This is the promised son, right? And he says, it's Isaac, and you love him. Right? Oh, man, what a tough thing for Abraham to carry, you know, all that information. Now, maybe there are more, you know, reasons than that. But that's a real test. I mean, this is not just a casual thing that God is saying to Abraham here. Did you have a question?
Well, no, I was wondering, is it also God telling Abraham, I know who Isaac is.
You know, it could be too.
He's your only son. You love him. You know, I'm very aware.
Yeah, that's true too. That's a good point. Yeah, that God is not a distant God. He's been following this. He knows Abraham's heart. That's a good point too. Yes.
Could God be saying, do you love me as much as you love Isaac?
Oh, that could be. Yeah, you put a lot of love, you put a lot of care into Isaac. Where am I in the picture here? That's another good point.
I'm going to test you and see just how much I mean to you.
Yeah. And then this part here, it'll be the third part of this little scene. Early the next morning, he gets up. Now, we just kind of, again, we skip over it real quickly. Let's move on to the rest of the story. But could we slow down there for just a second? Early the next morning.
Did he sleep?
He didn't hesitate.
Maybe he wasn't sleeping well. Just thinking about what he had to do. Might as well get up. It's early. What else? There might be several reasons going on here. Again, we don't have the answer. There are no footnotes to this. But it's just something, as you read the story, you hope to get involved enough in it to even begin to ask these kinds of questions.
Is there any way that God talked to him in his sleep?
Could be. I don't know, maybe visions. I know a lot of Muslims are coming to Jesus today because of visions. Any other reason you can think of? Why is he getting up early?
Well, if I got to do it, let's get it over with.
Maybe that's it. You know, let's get this thing done. Maybe it's so much faith. He says, "Boy, I can hardly wait to see what God's up to."
Maybe he didn't want Sarah to
know. No, not.
Oh, I don't think so.
Maybe he didn't want Sarah to know either.
See, that's Neil's hit upon something there. Who's not in this scene so far? Sarah. Now, you know, can you imagine, again, imagination? Abraham comes in that evening, right? The evening of this encounter with God. And he's washing up and he's sitting down. And Sarah says, "So how'd your day go out there with the sheep?" And he says, "Well, fine. Anything happen out there especially?" "No." "Well, yeah, actually I heard from God." "Oh, really? What did he say?" "Well, he wants me to go kill Isaac tomorrow." Now, you know, women and their kids, I mean, good heavens, women are like...
Probably take exception to that.
Yeah, so in a way, in my head, I'm kind of picturing him early morning, you know, doing this kind of thing.
Absolutely, yes.
And by the time Sarah kind of comes to, it's like, where'd they go? I don't know. I can't prove it again, and I'm not trying to, you know, change your view of Bible, of the Bible. But I'm just saying those are the kinds of things the Bible doesn't talk about and we can begin to think about. Let's do one other quick one here, just because of time deal. Exodus 8.
Well, to think about the fact that they're real people.
They are. They're real people. They had dirt under their fingernails, right? They scratched and, yeah. Exodus 8. We're at the start of the second plague. Okay, so we had the blood, Nile turning to blood. That didn't convince Pharaoh. It did temporarily, but he's backed off of that. They're now back under bondage, and he won't let them go. This is the plague of frogs. And it says frogs were everywhere. So we'll come back to that. Finally, Pharaoh's had it. He says, "Come here, Moses. I want this to stop." And Moses says in verse 9, "I leave to you the honor of setting the time for me to pray for you and your officials and your people, that you and your houses may be rid of the frogs." And Pharaoh says something very odd, and I wanted us to think about that for a second. He says,
tomorrow.
So let's use our imagination. Pharaoh's lying in his beautiful big bed, right? He gets the best bed in Egypt. And he rolls over in the night, and he rolls onto frogs. And he gets those out of the way. And then as he's lying there, several of them go across his forehead in the sleep, right? And that wakes him up immediately. And he gets up and he goes to the bathroom to start the day. He's stepping on frogs on the way in. He goes to the kitchen, pulls out his Cheerios, gets his cereal bowl, and looks down, and there's this huge frog sitting in the bottom of his cereal bowl. Right? Because, I mean, that's what it says. It says the frogs are everywhere. It says they're in your bedroom and on your bed. They're every place. And yet, Pharaoh says, when Moses says, "Up to you, you just let me know, and God will do it whenever you say," he says, "Tomorrow."
Tomorrow.
Now that seems really odd. Any thoughts on that?
I think
yeah, I would. If it was me, I'd say, "I got them all over me. How about, you know, this very moment?"
Now would be good.
Yeah, now it works for me. He says, "Tomorrow."
Tomorrow.
Any thought about that?
Maybe he wanted to talk to his men.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe they could better take care of them.
That could be. Maybe he's going to give them a little chance. Because remember, they were able to do some of the things that Aaron was doing. And so maybe he says, "Oh, okay, I'll give my guys a chance here." I think I came up with another reason. Anybody else have another reason?
What?
Oh, okay. Well, do you know people like that, that their dignity is so important that they pretend that they're still in command when they're really not in
Absolutely.
Command anymore?
Yeah, that's a good reason.
Do you ever fall and you get up, and instead of looking at how badly you got hurt, you look to see if anybody else was watching? Because it's your dignity that's at stake there. And you say things like, "I meant to do that." And, you know, just those stupid things that come out of your mouth because you don't want to look like an idiot. You walk into a closet and you're supposed to be going out the front door. And you're like, right? So here's Pharaoh, who's basically, I mean, at least this is my interpretation, you don't have to buy into it, but Pharaoh is sitting there going, "Well, I look like an idiot if I go right now, please. I'm Pharaoh, right? I'm the king of Egypt. I've got this cool headset on. Tomorrow's okay." So he's got another 24 hours of it because he doesn't want to look like a fool. Right? He's being cool. It's no big deal. I mean, sure, I'll let you guys go, but there's the frog sitting right here, you know. So to me, that's really, really funny. But it's more than funny. We're just using our imagination. And we don't have the time, but here's another place you can go to sometime. Look at Numbers 22. We won't turn there. That's the story of Balaam. I just want you to think about this. Balaam is known as a guy who can talk to God and make things happen. He can curse and he can bless. And so what happens? Do you know the story? The king of Moab is getting nervous. The children of Israel are coming through his territory. And he knows they've been knocking off other groups. And he's going, yikes, I want to lay some curses on these people. I got this high up place. I'm going to bring Balaam and have him look down on those people and just lay a curse on them. Of course, that doesn't happen that way. So here comes Balaam, and to help Balaam come, he's, of course, offered him some money, and he sends princes, you know, the sons of the king are going to escort Balaam. Now, if you're those princes and you're escorting Balaam and you know he's good with God, are you going to mess with him? Probably not, right? You're not going to do anything that would make Balaam mad at you. He might, you know, strike you down or something. So these guys are probably in awe. I'm just picturing it again. They're a little bit in awe of Balaam. And now they watch him as he can't control his own donkey. Until finally he's at the point of talking to the donkey. And not talking, I mean arguing with the donkey. So you're these guys that are thinking this is the high up guy. This is the important person who's going to cause, you know, all sorts of danger and destruction. Don't mess with him. And then you watch him having trouble controlling the donkey. You think about what's going through their heads. What did we get into here? Who thought this was a good idea? Has our father lost it completely? Does he know this guy's a complete moron that we're bringing in for this cursing? It doesn't say anything, but it makes you think about it. It's a good story. I hope you have a chance to read that. So that's what I mean by using your imagination a little bit more. Let's go to letter F here. Well, what do you do for poetry? Well, I told you there are two things that you look for. One is something called parallelism. You may have recognized the term, but even if you haven't, it's, you know, most people think of parallelism as math. But to the Hebrews, their poetry was not rhyming and it was not rhythm. It was parallelism. So what do I mean by parallelism? It's using the same grammatical structure more than one time in maybe a sentence or even two sentences right next to each other, and you say, well, I don't get it. You have heard parallelism whether you knew the term or not. When John Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what? You can do for your country. Do you hear how it sounds kind of the same? It's almost like a mirror image of what he said, but he did change it a little bit. Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address said he wanted government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not to perish from the earth. Why did he do that? It's not just saying the same thing three times. He changes the preposition of, by, and for. But they are three prepositional phrases in a row. And if you slow down and thought about it, it's a slightly different meaning that he's doing there. But it's that repetition that tickles our ear. Right? We just remember those kinds of things. Martin Luther King said, I don't want my children to be known by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Do you hear that? Color of skin, content of character. That's parallelism. And it is in, so I'm going to have you go back, if that's all right. Go back to Psalm 1 again. Did you see that parallelism at the beginning? It's really important. So don't skim over it. Don't think that these are authors that can't say anything clever, that they're just being repetitive. They're not being repetitive. They're doing this on purpose. So at the beginning it says, blessed is the man, and then we're going to get a three-part parallel passage, aren't we here? The man that does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, does not stand in the way of sinners, and does not sit in the seat of mockers. So what's he saying basically? Don't hang out with bad people. But he didn't say that. He said these three things, each one, you ought to slow down, because each one slightly says something different, doesn't it? Do you look at the verbs in all three of those? They're different. Does not walk, stand, or sit. Why those three? Do you think there's a progression of as you move through those three? If you walk with somebody, you're kind of in a hurry, right? And you're kind of haphazard in your communication, right? But if you stand and talk to people, aren't you more committed to that conversation and that person? And even more so, aren't you really committed if you're sitting with that person, you're in their house or you're someplace, you're devoting much more attention to them? So can you hear this progression? It's not saying the same thing three times. It's trying to hammer home, don't be walking with them, don't be standing with them, and for heaven's sake, don't be sitting with them. Right? You're just getting yourself tied in more and more into that lifestyle. Don't do that. So that's parallelism. It's all through the poetry in the Bible. So don't look for rhymes. You're not going to hear rhyming in there. You're not going to hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not going to have a beat to it. Parallelism is the way they got it across, because they wanted you to slow down, like we were talking about before. You're more meditative if you say, wow, I don't want to be hanging around with bad people, right? But it tells you three ways that you don't want to hang around with bad people. That's parallelism to slow you down, to get you to thinking about what they're talking about. And the other thing is a figure of speech. The Bible and the poetry often uses figures of speech. The Lord is my shepherd, right? Why not just say, God is a wonderful guide? Well, I don't know what guide means, right? I don't have any picture in my head, but God is my shepherd. Here it says, a person, right? We're going to talk about these figures of speech. A person is like a tree. At first you go, what? People talk, people move, people think. Trees don't do that. Yeah, but look how he's making that comparison. Did he pull off his high wire act? He says, he's like a tree. How? How can people be like trees? He says three ways. They can be planted by streams of water, they can yield its fruit, and the leaf will not wither. Okay, so let's go through those three. That's parallelism too, isn't it? Can you be planted by streams of water? Can you be nourished? Can people be nourished?
Sure.
That's what we're doing here at church, right? This is a time for streams to come by us, to rejuvenate us. We're going to soak it up today at church. Can we have fruit?
Sure.
Can the leaf not wither? Well, how about the other way around? You ever put a tree in your somewhere in your garden or something, and you're really looking forward to it, and it was green at the beginning, but the leaves withered? Do you know people like that? They had a good start in life, and somehow they didn't pan out. And then, so he says, these people, when they're planted, man, they bloom, and their leaves look good. There's real promise there. So do you see the comparison that's being made? And again, slow down and enjoy that. The ones that are not so good here are like chaff. So real quick, picture story, what's chaff?
What's left over in straw when it's been harvested,
yeah.
Thrashed.
Yeah, when you've taken the grain, the good stuff's on the inside, right? It's usually covered with a shell. It's like a kind of a transparent shell. That's the chaff. So now when you thresh it, you've got the grain, but you've also got the chaff. So how do you get rid of the chaff? Yeah. You throw it physically or something like that, and it's so light, it gets carried as long as it's a semi-windy day, and then the good stuff is solid, and it lands, and it comes back, and it's yours. So can people be like chaff? At first you think, how can a person be like chaff? Well, do you know people that just get carried away with whatever the in fad is? Right? That's the wind for them. They just go whatever direction the current in thing is. They don't have any solidity to them. They don't have any gravitas. You know, that was the word they used in an election way back when. But a lot of people don't have that kind of gravitas. You don't bother hanging around them because they're not very interesting. They don't have anything interesting to say. And they're saying that's the way the wicked are. There's nothing to them. They just, and they're gone. So that's that figure of speech, that connection that's being made. You go, oh, I get it. That's kind of a cool thing to think about. So there's some poetry for you to think about. We don't have the time today, but I hope you could look at Judges 5. Why? Because it's right next to Judges 4. Okay, but that's not a joke. Judges 4 is a story. It's a story of Deborah getting an army together. And then Judges 5 is the Song of Deborah, which is a very old part of the Bible, and it's the song of their victory. And I'd like you, if you have some time, look at the end of that. There's a woman in the story named Jael who takes the enemy captain who's running for his life. He's exhausted. He falls asleep at her tent. Do you know the story? She takes a tent peg while he's asleep. Wham! And he's done. Well, most people read that. They don't read the Song of Deborah next to it. Read that and notice how it turns it into like a slow motion kind of thing. It's interesting how the poetry is done there. So I hope you have a chance to take a look at that. I did mention there are other genres in the Bible. I'm down to letter G. Here are some of them. We don't have the time today, but just to think about, there are proverbs in the Bible. There are parables. Jesus expressed a lot of truth through his parables. There are epistles, the letters in the Bible, the gospels. Satire, there's visionary literature, sometimes called apocalyptic writing. Most people think of Revelation, but it's in other places in the Old Testament as well. So all of those things have certain rules. In other words, these people are not inventing this stuff. They are taking what God tells them and they're putting it into a package, into a form that you should know something about. And if you know something, you know, you have a good time with it. So what's my conclusion? Well, God inspired the Bible. Isn't that great that he put it in forms that we can enjoy? Something that'll touch our heart, something that'll stay in our head for a long time, especially the stories and the poems. So slow down, use your imagination, And then I put my email at the bottom there. I have, if you care about it, you can email me. I'll send you a link to a bunch of audio lectures that I did for my Bible class out of Palomar College. And so you can listen to some of these kinds of things that I was talking about today in case it went by too fast. But it's fascinating what's in the Bible, and I hope you enjoy it, and I know you do. But just reading a little differently may make a difference too.